Mike McEntee. Welcome to Thursday, otherwise known as Post Rudy Giuliani Announcement Day. Did you catch what he said on Fox News? Of course you did. Well, you maybe didn't see it live, but everybody's been talking about it. You know, the White House today just responding that, hey, we didn't lie, we just didn't know.
They gave you the best information that I had, and I'm going to continue to do my best to do that every single day.
Yeah, that was Sarah Huckabee Sanders saying that she didn't know until last night that President Trump was reimbursing Michael Cohen for paying $130,000 in hush money to Stormy Daniels right before the presidential election. Does that sound like a strange plot for a movie? No, that's really what's going on. Are you buying that or that Trump's defense that he didn't know the money was going to Cohen? We're going to open the phones a little bit later on the show, 952-946-6205. Not right now, but a little bit later on the show. And you may want to talk about that. Also, what were you doing when you were 15? How about leading a major political action? Later on the show, we're going to talk to a high school student who is active in politics and trying to get elected. But first, tonight, you've got one last opportunity, at least for the time being, to see the winner of the Best Minnesota Documentary at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. It's called Dodging Bullets, Stories of Survivors of Historical Trauma, and it's showing again tonight at 7 o'clock at the St. Anthony Mayton Theater in Minneapolis. And joining us now are two of the film's directors, Kathy Brewer and Bob Trench. Bob and Kathy, welcome to the program.
Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
First, congratulations. Completing a documentary film is an achievement. I've been there. And then being picked as the best Minnesota documentary at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival is quite an honor. There's a lot of competition there. So congratulations to both of you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So I got a chance to see this the other night, and I want to talk about the film, but I want you to explain to people what this is about. And let me just set this up just a little bit for people. This is about Native Americans and having to deal with everything Native Americans have to deal with these days, I guess is one way of putting it. And the key phrase here is in the name of the movie, the kind of the tag, which is historical trauma. And this documentary starts out here with a lot of different things, but one of them is an interview with Melissa Walls, a PhD associate professor at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and she tries to explain what this is.
So historical trauma, the first thing I'd say about it is it means a lot of different things. And there's a healthy debate going on right now among academics, and I think probably in communities too, about what is this thing that we call historical trauma.
And that seems to pervade the film, this discussion about this, although it's about a lot of other things. So I want to ask you both, and maybe Kathy, we start with you. What is historical trauma, and what's it have to do with this movie?
Well, a lot. Historical trauma is about the trauma that our ancestors have had in their lives. For example, with the Blackfeet people, we had a starvation winter in the 1800s, and that changes a person. It not only changes their demeanor and the way they interact with the world, but it also changes the way they are on the inside. There's some physiological changes. And because of that, it's passed down to the other generations, and it affects the people here and now.
So what happened?
We've gotten a lot of that research from, like, Holocaust survivors, and how some of those changes have been physiological and psychological and social have been passed down to other generations.
And so it's not just, hey, my parents acted this way, so I act this way, but it's, from what I understand, the research and what you're talking about is that's in the DNA, that actually goes from one person to another, and it's felt even though that person had no other connection with what happened generations ago.
Exactly. And from what my understanding is that we have this amazing coding along our DNA from what has been explained to me. It's almost a protected coding. And that's what gets changed. And because some of that stuff gets changed, it does, in fact, get passed down because we learn different techniques. Our body learns different reactions on how to handle trauma. And when trauma happens, it does change our bodies. We may pass down also the ability to manage that trauma if we've managed it ourselves, But if we have not addressed our own trauma, then we also pass down our not so good coping skills. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense, although I'm sure some people listening have some skepticism about that, but there's actual science behind this, is what you're telling me.
There is. Yeah, okay. Absolutely. Absolutely. Now, there's a lot of research behind it because of the things that not only Native American people, Indian people have had to endure, but also Holocaust victims that of brutal crimes, incest or abuse. And when they do that kind of research with people who have experienced those kind of traumas, we know that there's a change. They're more acceptable. For example, in Indian country, we have a lot of autoimmune diseases, excuse me, like lupus and arthritis. And, I can't think off the top of my head, but those, and they have been researched and found out that those are responses that people who have experienced historical trauma, our ancestors who have experienced historical trauma, passed down those physical ailments.
Now, this movie is made up of many different stories, many different segments. It was produced by a group of directors, I think five directors at least. Bob, in one of these segments, it was talked about that Native Americans really don't want to talk about historical trauma because it might be viewed as a crutch. How do Native American audiences react to this film when they see this discussion?
Well, it's very interesting. We've taken the film and screened it in private screenings to get an idea of how people do react to it. Do they trigger? Is there a problem? Did we get the film right? And one thing that I found out was very interesting is when I take it into non-Native communities, I get a lot of people really paying attention and watching it. When we screen it to Native communities, they're looking for, is this film done right? I'm non-Native, so they look at me and say, are you telling our story? Is the film done right? And I wanted to make sure that it is not my story, but it is Indian country's story. It's Native stories. So I actually will let them watch it and see if they're into it or not. So we focus grouped it at two middle schools here in the Twin Cities, and both of them have Native populations. And the responses I got were very excellent. They related to it. They understood the problem. They get it. Then I took it to a non-Native school here in the Twin Cities and focus grouped it among the same group of kids. And there were questions about first contact, about Columbus. There was a real lack of understanding of what happened in history to Native people. So I think that in itself is a good point. Native people will watch it to confirm what has happened to them. Non-Native people will watch it to learn more about what actually is really happening.
I mentioned I did a film, and I kind of faced a similar situation. It was about the LGBT community, which I'm not a member of. It was called How Love Won. It was about marriage equality. And, you know, Kathy, you're Native American with the Blackfeet Nation. Bobby said you're not. How do you tell a community story when you're not part of the community? How do you get it right?
There is only one way to get it right, and that's why we have co-directors on the film. You have to work with Native people in the community to help tell the story. And as you know from your film, which is, by the way, a beautiful, wonderful film that you did,
oh, thanks.
Unless you had good relationships with your community, you would not get stories. So as a non-Native, how can I pick up the phone and call somebody and say, hey, I want to interview you about the police shooting that happened in Browning? No one's going to return my phone call. They don't know me. They don't trust me. And they don't trust me for good reason. So that's why you have to develop the relationships, and you have to have equal footing with partners. If it's in the gay community and you're doing a film on gays, you have to have equal footing with people in that industry. They have to be working with you hand in hand.
Now, Kathy,
exactly. And I think the other piece to that is Bob was willing to come in and listen, and his crew. They wanted to hear the stories. They weren't here to save the Indian. They weren't here to look at the poor Indian. They were here to listen to stories. And when you're there to listen and you're genuine, we'll tell stories.
Now, Kathy, you did a segment that's featured in a couple places in the film. It's about I'm not giving anything away. It's about a sibling talking about her brother who was killed, and it's mm-hmm. a really emotional segment. And I'm wondering, how did you get her to agree to sit down and tell this story in the way that it was told?
Well, we got to talk for a little bit before, Mike, about what my background is I'm a marriage and family therapist, and I've worked in the school systems for about 20 years. And so I'd been working with this girl and had known her. And we were dealing with a lot of different trauma and grief. And so when I approached her about telling her story, I want to tell my story because I want other people to know the journey. It was very soon after her brother had been killed. And after her brother was killed, and he was killed in their home, he was using meth. His had threatened to hurt his grandma, who had been raising all the children. And so the police had to come in. And then he was killed, shot and killed. But what happened after this is 2 weeks after this, the grandpa who raised her died. The uncle that she was raised with died. The other uncle she was raised with died. So within a 6 month or 6 week period, Sheila had lost four people in her life. And it makes me think back to not only her historical trauma and how it has changed her, but also what she will be passing down to her generation, to her children, because of her historical trauma.
Now, the deaths that you're mentioning, a lot of the death that's talked about in this movie is about suicide, and that mm-hmm. Suicide rates are connected to historical trauma. I don't know if that was the case here, but tell me about that, because I think a lot of people don't realize that.
And it's all a connection. It's like not separate segments, but a connection. So we have the historical trauma. And in Indian country, and I think sometimes in rural America, we have this buck up, shut up and buck up. Mm-hmm. And so we don't talk about it. We just assume this is life, and we try to move on. But when we do that, we sometimes have ill-affected ways in coping, whether it's drug use, alcohol use, gambling, any of those. And so if they, in fact, have those kinds of ways of coping, they're not doing well. And then that can lead to suicide because we have high levels of sadness, high levels of depression, and it's unresolved, meaning they don't have an opportunity to talk about it and to heal. And so they have, they're at high risk for suicide. And because of that, we do have a very high, Montana has like number one percentage rate for suicide. And then our Native American communities are the highest areas in Montana that are for suicide.
We're speaking with Kathy Brewer and Bob Trench. They are two of the directors of a film that's showing tonight. It's the best Minnesota documentary at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival. It's called Dodging Bullets. And I want to ask about that name and where the idea for the film came from, because there's always somebody has the genesis of the idea. And I'm wondering, I mean, where did this film come from? And was it all just full blown, this is what it's going to be? Or was it a discovery? What was the path that got us to what we were going to see on the screen?
Well, I 100% will give Sarah Edstrom, one of the co-directors who works in the Native community here in Minneapolis, the credit for the film. She has worked with women in crisis for many years. She studied historical trauma in school, and she really opened my eyes up to what historical trauma was. The name is even more interesting because doing research footage, we're traveling around at the beginning, you know, going to Montana, filming people just to find out, is there a story here? And I reached out to Dennis Banks and said, I got a question for you. I want to come up and talk to you. And he said, come on up. And I was able to spend a whole day with him, 4 hours just sitting at his house talking about what's going on. And the kids are growing up today are having problems. And if you're going to do a film, you have to incorporate kids. It can't all be about the elder and the older generation, because the kids are the ones we have to help. right today because they're our future. And we were talking about the name, and he was, and I had mentioned Dodging Bullets to him, and he said, "Bob, I love the name. We've been dodging bullets for generations," and it just fit as a perfect title for the film.
Yeah, and the segment that Kathy worked on, I think it just embodies that completely as the metaphor for the film, and it's a great way that kind of ties things together. There's so many parts of this. I know we're not going to have time to get into everything, but there was a segment that was very Minnesota centric. It was very Twin City centric, and it was having to do with when I won't even say the name of the team, the Washington football team, that came mm-hmm. to play here in Minnesota, and the protests that were around that, and Jesse Ventura of all people shows up in this thing as well. Tell me why you decided to focus on that, and what relevance that has to everything that we've been talking about here with historical trauma.
You know, I asked before we filmed that segment and got into it and edited it. I asked a lot of people in Indian country what their opinions on that name were, and I got varying answers. But Tara Huska gave me basically the bottom line: it does affect the children today. And she states that mm-hmm. in the film. If children see derogatory names about themselves and their ancestors and the color of their skin over and over and over again, they lose self-esteem. So that's why mm-hmm. we kept it in. And, you know, we talked about, do we want to put this in there? Because there's another wonderful film out about the naming controversy right now. And so we thought it's a shorter segment. It's important to put it in. And it sends a message of what's going on in today's society. And as a documentarian, it's all about documenting a point in time in history. And if we were to leave that out, I think we're leaving out an important time in history where people where a football team has a name that's racist.
Another important time in history, which I was kind of vaguely aware of, was the whole boarding school era, which mm-hmm. went on for quite some time. And I mean, it's horrific to think that Native Americans were used essentially as slave labor to build these schools that essentially took away their kids. That's what this is about, and so much more. Mm-hmm. Bob, you were involved in the research on that one. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, it's interesting. We knew we needed to talk about boarding school, but we didn't have anybody that we could talk to. I reached out to many of the Catholic churches and the old retired priests and tried to get somebody. And then I ran into a woman from Minnesota named Sasha Brown. Sorry about the dog, guys. Mm-hmm. And she told me about her father, who was at St. Augustine's school down in Nebraska. And she said, reach out to him and talk to him. And Melvin Lee Houston invited us down to Nebraska, and we spent hours with him talking. And he has such a wonderful voice, and he is so knowledgeable because he has, from six years old on, he was in a boarding school. And he told us what happened to him, and he told us what happened to other people with him. It was truly, truly fascinating. And, you know, the great thing about me working in Indian country, I am friends with Melvin today. I didn't just go in and film him and leave him and it's gone. I talked to him last week. My goal is to talk to him once or twice a month if I can. And I try to keep those relationships up because Melvin taught me a lot about life. I'm in my late 50s. I learned a lot about life from Melvin, which I think is important to keep learning throughout your life.
Yeah. Yeah. It's connection. It's kind of weird. I kind of felt the same thing when I went and shot folks that I had not met before, but they almost became, they became very good friends later because of just, you know, continuous contact that you have. We have to run, but I want to remind people that the movie, this is called Dodging Bullets, is showing tonight. It's, I think, the only showing left here at the Minneapolis-St. Paul International Film Festival for it, but it is the winner of the Best Minnesota Documentary. It is going to be showing at 7 o'clock at the St. Anthony Main Theater in Minneapolis. And Kathy Brewer, Bob Trench, I thank you both for being with me, but I got one last question. I noticed in the credits a very strange thing. Maybe you can explain. It said, no filming was done in Wyoming. Why was that in there? What does that mean?
Well, first of all, thank the Minneapolis-St. Paul Film Festival for putting us in it. I really appreciate what Craig Rice has done and helped us get exposure for the film. Secondly, boy, when we were out filming in South Dakota and Nebraska and Colorado, and we were heading through Wyoming, which is Indian country, there was an article in the paper, and I was reading it, and they were trying to pass a law to make it illegal for filmmakers to shoot anything at all in Wyoming without getting a permit. You want to go out and shoot some land, can't do it. And what they're trying to do is trying to protect their conservative businesses. And there's a lot of oil and fracking that goes on out in Wyoming, and they don't want people filming it because they want to keep that a secret. I put it in there. I think it's wrong. The press should always be able to be open and film people.
Amen to that. Hey, I appreciate you both. Bob, I know that you're going to be over at the showing tonight, and so folks should go on over and maybe get a chance to ask you some questions. So,
beautiful. Thank you very much.
All right, Kathy, thank you, too.
Thanks, Mike.
We're going to take a break here, folks, but when we get back, the stuff that's happening in the White House, I want your reaction to what's going on. 952-946-6205, your reaction to Trump admitting he reimbursed the money to pay off Stormy Daniels. We'll talk about that and more next year on the Mike McEntee Show.
Tom Hartman here, letting you know how you can go solar with All Energy Solar, even way up north in Minnesota. Lots of people ask them, isn't Minnesota too cloudy for solar? No. The truth? For one thing, Minneapolis gets nearly as much sun each year as Houston, Texas. But it isn't just about how much sun you get. It's also about having access to great local incentive programs that make solar affordable. Learn what your options are to save with solar and visit allenergysolar.com today.
Tap, taste, and treasure at Vinaigrette, where we have some warm seasonal recipes all ready to create dynamite meals. Our fig balsamic vinegar pairs perfectly with roasted Brussels sprouts or baked brie. And sweet potatoes are always a winner, but never more than when they're roasted with a drizzle of vinaigrette cinnamon or orange-fused extra virgin olive oil on top. Come in today for more custom-crafted food and cocktail recipes at Vinaigrette, 50th and Xerxes in Minneapolis and 287 Water Street in downtown Excelsior. Online at vinaigrettemn.com.
The number one source of the Twin Cities gay scene is All Digital. Follow Twin Cities Gay Scene on Facebook and Twitter. Sign up for the Scene Shot email blast for weekly updates and chances to win great prizes. No app is needed to view the bi-weekly web editions of Scene. It's GLBTQ media for the mobile generation. Find it all at TwinCitiesGayScene.com. That's TwinCitiesGayScene.com.
Northeast Minneapolis is known for its creativity, and you'll know exactly why when you eat at Hazel's Northeast. Their creatively prepared comfort food will have you coming back week after week. Breakfasts like biscuits and gravy, granola pancakes, and brisket hash. For lunch, homemade soup and one of the best Reubens in town. And don't miss the daily risotto or Chef Ali's ever-changing dinner specials. Come on in, bring the whole family. Hazel's Northeast delivers real good food. Family owned at 29th and Johnson in Minneapolis.
Hey, it's Mike McEntee back here on AM 950. Washington, and I think a lot of places, are a Twitter about what's been said here last night by Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani kind of blew the top off of things here with the whole Stormy Daniels, Trump's not paying, not I didn't have anything to do with this paying money to Michael Cohen. No, actually, he reimbursed him, I should say, his payment to her. So, when the president lies about this, how can we believe anything he says? White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders had a lot of explaining to do about that today.
When the president so often says things that turn out not to be true, when the president and the White House show what appears to be a blatant disregard for the truth, how are the American people to trust or believe what is said here or what is said by the president?
We give the very best information that we have at the time. I do that every single day and will continue to do that every day I'm in this position.
But the president, I mean, he, when the story first happened, it said, came out that Ty Cobb would be leaving and Emmett Flood would be coming in. The president said fake news, said it was not true. He just, when he talked about the prisoners in North Korea, he said the previous administration had been failed to get them out. These two of them were taken prisoner while
Donald Trump was president. And obviously the totally conflicting statements on the Stormy Daniels payment, these are statements that are just not true.
When it comes to North Korea, there, I think you could also look at Otto Wambrier, who was detained during a previous administration, as was one of the current detainees. And so that would reflect the president's comments that he made. When it comes to the other, the last instance that you mentioned, as Mayor Giuliani stated, this wasn't something that was initially known, but later learned. And again, we give the best information possible at the time, and we're going to continue to do that every single day.
He started paying back Michael Cohen back in February of last year. I mean, the reimbursement was happening long before the president was asked about this.
Is that a question or?
But I'm saying, I mean, how could he not have known? He was paying him back.
Again, I'm not going to get into those details, and I would refer you back to the statements, pretty lengthy statements made by Giuliani both last night and this morning, as well as the president's tweets where they've both spoken about that. Jim?
We don't want to talk about that. The president's lying. You caught us. Please look the other direction. And this is going on every day in Washington, D.C. The question is whether people care anymore. 952-946-6205. Your thoughts on this or the entire story that's happening out of D.C.? Julie from Minneapolis wants to join us and talk about that. Hi, Julie. How are you doing today?
Hi. Okay, thanks for taking my call. I'd like you to tell me why I'm wrong. I want to hear the counter argument.
Okay, I'm not good at that, but go ahead.
Most legal experts are saying that you cannot indict a sitting president. So, and Mueller is a straight arrow guy. He's an institution guy. He's not in the end going to want to set a precedent that can come back to haunt us 20 years from now. So, the idea is, if you can't indict a sitting president, to me, it seems that nothing is relevant. The Stormy Daniels, possible crooked campaign behavior, money laundering through the Russians and other worldwide banks, et cetera. Nothing matters because you can't indict a sitting president. What do you have to say to me?
You know, I'm not a legal expert in that is what I'll say. But here's what I know is more important to people than indicting, and that's impeaching. And impeaching doesn't
okay.
have to be for a criminal offense. It just has to be that basically it's a political act. It just basically is, you know what, we're fed up. We can't take this anymore. There's been too much junk going on. And yes, I know it has to be it can be high crimes, misdemeanors, or whatever it can be, they want to use the phrase for. But it's a political act.
Mm-hmm.
And if indeed there's enough evidence in the court of public opinion that Congress feels they need to act to do something, that's probably the more important thing than indicting. And again, I'm not an expert in that area.
I don't think the American people care. What's your take? I think they're so numb to Mr. Sleazeball in the Oval Office and Mr. Dishonest. I don't think they care, but I don't have a feeling for people out there. What's your opinion on that? Do you think people care?
I think a lot of people do care, but there's a certain number of people who are insulated against this and wouldn't, you know, as Donald Trump said, he could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and they wouldn't care
right.
Because of, you know, whatever they believe that he's doing that, you know, they're supporting. And then there's the people mm-hmm. who are in the middle on this, who I think it's been like the frog in the boiling pot of water.
Right.
I mean, if this was all at once. And we've had this happening. I mean, every headline I read today, if I read that, 2 years ago, there would have been an explosion. But today it's just like, oh, it's another thing out of the Trump administration. And it becomes normal.
Yeah,
and that's
numb.
What's really
scary.
We're
numb to this evil guy. That's my take. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the comment, Julie. I appreciate it. David from New Hope is on the line. Hey, David, you were thinking about Sarah Huckabee Sanders. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, I'm fine. Just a quick, modest proposal, I guess you might call it. I would like to suggest that the press corps boycott her. The information, you know, they ask questions and she lies.
Mm-hmm.
Why bother to ask the question and why bother to pay any attention to her answer? How about if the entire press corps just doesn't even show up for about a week? Maybe that'll send a message.
You know, that's an interesting idea, but I can tell you why it wouldn't work. It's because there's too much competition, and I think the comedian at the White House press dinner got it right when
yeah.
she pointed at the press and said, "You folks have been making money off of all of this, and that's why you keep promoting it." And that's what drives us is, you know, it's a lot about eyeballs. It's unfortunately, it's a train wreck, and people like to watch a train wreck.
Well, it is a train wreck. And I suppose the Fox News reporters will be there no matter what.
Yeah, probably. Hey, yeah. I appreciate the thought on that, David. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
We'll take just a couple of more calls here, and then we got an interview coming up here. But Phil's on the line from Golden Valley. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Mike. I think that the way the people who watch faux news have been brainwashed, and their ability to absorb malarkey and baloney, their tolerance for it is so high, every little bit that gets added doesn't really make much difference. I mean, think back to the, a few years ago, there was a president named Obama. He wore a tan suit one day, and the news was like, oh, my God, the president wore a tan suit.
Yeah.
And
don't you long for those days?
One day to the next, how many lawyers has he gone through? Will he or won't he actually tell the truth about anything? Does his press office actually tell what make true statements about facts that are refuted the next day? If any one day's worth of insanity in the Trump administration would have happened, think about the Clinton administration. Yeah, they investigated the Clintons for his whole administration. And how did they get evidence about that the president had an extramarital affair? They illegally wiretapped a conversation between an intern and a woman who she met. That was an illegally tapped conversation because in Maryland, you have to have the approval of both parties to the conversation to have a recording being made. And only the person making the recording knew that recording was being made. So they had evidence that was illegally obtained, and they went to the president and said, we have evidence that you might be having an illicit affair. And he said, well, I don't know what you got, but okay. So he went through that, and it was drawn out long enough that eventually they said, this is ridiculous. And it was.
Yeah.
Now we have a president whose whole life has been scams and cons and bad deals that he always seems to come out on top. He always seems to be the one who comes out on top. He's been involved. It's been publicly stated he has been involved in over 3,000 legal cases, suits, where he has either sued a vendor or a vendor has sued him. And at any given time before he ran for president, he was involved in several dozen different lawsuits. And somehow he always mostly came out on top because he just bullied people. And now the whole country is being bullied. And I just don't know how much more bullying enough people in this country are going to decide that they have put up with enough.
Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people have had enough, and 2018 in November is when they're going to have their chance to really have something to say.
It seems as though the Republican Party has an infinite ability to put up with baloney.
Yeah.
As long as they're on the side of the gravy train that gets the gravy.
I think a lot of folks would agree with you, Phil. They would. I got one more phone call I'm going to take here, folks, before we get to break. Phil, thank you for your comment. Betsy from Minneapolis has been waiting on the line, and then
my call. I think it was real interesting today. I only saw a very, very small portion of it, or heard it, I should say, and I think it was just now on your show, to tell you the truth. But I do watch the press conferences, and I think the tide turned today. I think they are actually saying to her, that was not the truth. And sure, they're not calling them a liar. You know, that's a charged word. So at least they're saying that is not accurate. The North Korean thing that he talked about, not accurate. So it's good when they call them out on it. I think that's, thanks, Michelle.
Yes, thank it, the press is growing a pair, I think, is one way that's is being put.
And I think thanks, Michelle, is due. I think they should quit picking on her and give her a big round of applause.
Okay. Betsy, thank you for your phone call.
Thank you for taking it. Have a great day.
You too. We're going to take a break here, folks. But when we get back, I want to talk to somebody who is active in politics and is very, very young for doing so and has already had an impact. We'll do that next year on the Mike McIntyre Show.
Hi, this is Paul Metza inviting you to listen to the Wall of Power Radio Hour every weekend on AM 950. We are now in our third year of broadcasting on the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. MinPost has called us one of the 22 most independently entertaining and cool radio shows in the Twin Cities. We feature cool people from all walks of life and from all 50 states every Saturday at 6 p.m., replayed Sunday at 4 p.m. on AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Damian Strange, Executive Director of Northeast Minneapolis Arts Association, NEMA, and I'm personally inviting you to Arter World May 18th through the 20th. View artwork of over 650 artists in every medium at more than 50 locations throughout Northeast Minneapolis, including studio buildings, art galleries, homes, storefronts, and local businesses. The Artist Open Studio Tour may include demonstrations, mini workshops, installations, and special exhibitions. Studio tours offer a great opportunity to ask questions, discuss techniques, experience art firsthand, and purchase unique artwork directly from artists. Arter World gives you a unique opportunity to meet the artists who make our community so vibrant and invest in our art community by purchasing artwork that you connect with. For more information, go to NEMAA.org. That's NEMA.org. Looking forward to seeing you at Arter World.
National Camera Exchange's Colossal Camera Sale is finally here, one weekend only, Thursday, May 3rd through Monday, May 7th. Join us for the biggest sale of the season when everything in the store is on sale. Save up to 30% on frames, albums, media cards, filters, accessories, and used equipment. National Camera's Colossal Camera Sale features incredible savings this weekend only. Save big on the Nikon D3400-2 lens bundle, which includes a 24.2 megapixel Instant Connect camera with two zoom lenses plus free gadget bag. Now only $499. Save $350. Or a Canon EOS T6 II lens kit featuring an 18-megapixel CMOS sensor, making it great for low light. Now only $449. Save $300. Hurry in and save up to 30% on hundreds of items at the Colossal Camera Sale, Thursday through Monday, May 3rd through the 7th at National Camera Exchange. More details at natcam.com.
Mike McIntyre back with you here on AM 950. I know a lot of our listeners are very active in politics. When did you first get involved in politics? I mean, more than going just to vote, but taking a political action, getting involved in the party. Was it your 40s, your 30s, maybe when it was when you were in college? Our next guest is running for a political party position, and she's 15. She's a high school student. Isra Hirsi wants to be the chair of the Minnesota High School Democrats, and she's been a very visible activist against gun violence. She joins us now. Isra, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you on. And did I pronounce your name correctly?
Yes.
Okay, good, because we didn't get a chance to chat ahead of time. Tell me why you're involved. I mean, you're doing a lot of different things. You've been involved in leading the walkout here against gun violence at the schools. You're active in the political party. What's gotten you involved? Why are you passionate about what you're doing here?
Well, it all started when I was really young. I attended my first protest at 6, only because my parents really helped me get started. And then I started learning about the injustices in the world, and it really made me upset. And so I thought, what could I do about it? And then I realized that activism was a really simple way for me to help get involved.
You mentioned your parents. Now, I assume you got your parents' support in what you're doing on here?
Yes.
And your mother's pretty well known, isn't she?
Yep, she is.
She is a representative in the Minnesota House, and I assume that she's rather proud of what you're doing.
Yeah, actually, she's been very supportive, and helps me a lot along the way with a lot of the things I'm involved in.
Now, you are running for the chair of the Minnesota High School Democrats. This is an organization made up of high school students, but a lot of the students that are in that organization, I think, are a few years older than you. You're a sophomore this year?
I'm a freshman, actually.
You're a freshman. Freshman. Okay. So you're... I was in high school, and the freshmen were referred to as the lowly freshmen. No diss on you, but that's kind of how the caste system works in high school. So you're challenging some older high schoolers to be the leader of the organization. What's the reaction you're getting from other high schoolers that when you're seeking this position?
Well, personally, I always thought that they'd see me as just like a little kid, since I technically am one, but it's been surprising, actually. A lot of people have been really supportive, especially classmates and upperclassmen in my own high school. I really thought they'd be against me, but in all reality, they really want to see me succeed.
Now, you've had to take some very public stances here in the last couple of months. You organized the walkout at South High, I believe, in February. When you did that, what was that like? Was that a little bit outside your comfort zone?
Yes, actually. It was really overwhelming to organize. I never actually done anything before until I went on a whim and decided to last minute. And so it was pretty insane. But I'm really glad I did it. It was a great experience.
Did you have, you had to get up and speak in front of a crowd? I mean, obviously you're speaking in front of a crowd here on the radio. That can be nerve-wracking a little bit. Was it nerve-wracking speaking in front of your fellow classmates?
Yes, actually. On that protest on the 21st of February, it was the first time I've actually spoken in front of that many people, especially since most of them are my peers and people my own age, and it was truly terrifying. But after I did that, I felt I gained a lot of confidence, and then I was able to speak like I am right now.
Mm-hmm. So it was terrifying. When we push ourselves to do things that are terrifying, there has to be a reason for it. You think you talked a little bit about it, but tell me again, what got you to stand up in front of that crowd and get things organized and do something?
I realized that if I wasn't going to be the one to do it, somebody will. And obviously there wasn't anybody stepping up at the time, so I decided to take a stand. And obviously there's a lot of things that have gone unaddressed, and I definitely felt like if I wanted those things to be addressed, I had to be the one making that happen.
And when we talk about getting your voice heard, I saw that you tweeted a while back that you want to make sure that POC, people of color's voices, are always heard. Why is that important?
It's important because most of the issues that are being talked about today affect people of color more than a white person, and they're usually disregarded when finding solutions for these problems. And that makes it oftentimes worse, and that doesn't always work.
Now, the protests that you were originally involved in here had to do with gun violence, and we've had absolutely zero happen in the Minnesota legislature about doing anything about gun violence. There's a little bit of hope because I think there's a Republican-backed bill that may get some hearing here in the last couple of weeks of the session. But when you look at that, do you get discouraged that the politicians don't seem to be listening to you and a lot of other people?
Yes, I definitely do get discouraged. There's so many Republicans in the House that refuse to vote on gun law bills. And then I realized that midterms are in November and we have the opportunity to vote them out. Not me specifically, but my peers and mm-hmm. people in my community, and so there's still some hope.
If you had an opportunity, maybe you have had an opportunity, to meet with some of the legislators who are, you know, notoriously opposed to changing our gun laws, to put some, you know, sensible gun regulations in place, if you had that opportunity, what would you say to them?
I would say that they need to stop being cowards, and they need to realize that people in their communities are dying because they refuse to do something about it. And we don't have a lot of time left. This has been going on for way too long. And obviously they must either be confused or blind to not see the issue. So I would say step up and notice the issues and do something about it and not just be a bystander.
Do you tell that to your fellow classmates? Do they get it too? Are they joining in with you? Do you have a large group, you know, kind of behind you saying, yeah, we get it, we're with you?
Yes, actually.
And, I mean, you're running here for the leadership in this group. That's one thing, and we'll talk about that just in a second here. But what else can you do between, you know, as a student in high school at the age of 15, what other plans do you have here to try to have an impact?
Definitely getting involved with local politics and, you know, supporting candidates to support your own views, attending protests, and writing letters to your legislators and people in Congress.
Okay, that's a good start. I think it's a list anybody could ascribe to getting something done. And then you're running to be the chair of the Minnesota High School Democrats. Tell us what that group is and why you want to be in charge of it. Give us what's your elevator speech when you talk to somebody else saying this is why you need to vote for me.
Well, Minnesota High School Democrats is a group of youth that are that identify with the Democratic Party. They advocate for Democratic views and positions and support Democratic candidates. And so this group is 100% led by youth, and it is across the state. And it is a pretty empowering group, actually. They have been doing a lot of work, and they have chapters all across the state. And it's definitely something that a lot of high school students should definitely get involved with, because they are a true example of how to get involved and how to make change.
Now, you're only 15, and I say that only because I used the word only because that's not to diminish you, but the age for voting is 18. The age to run for office is sometimes higher than that. Do you want to run for office?
Yes, I do.
And I think I saw on your Twitter feed that you have a particular office in mind in 2048.
Yes, I want to run for president in 2048.
You want to run for president in 2048. Why would you want to do that, especially when you see all the stuff that goes on in the, you know, that the you saw what President Obama had to endure. You saw what is going on around Donald Trump. Why would you want to be president?
I want to be president because I know that the chances of me becoming president as a Black Muslim woman is pretty slim. But if I do end up getting in that office, I could be a role model for hundreds of thousands of girls that look like me that never have that figure. And I can definitely, I experience things that the Black community experience, that the Muslim community experience, and I feel like having somebody in that position can definitely make a huge change for this country and definitely make people open their eyes a little and notice that there's a lot of things that need to be changed.
All right. Well, I admire your ambition. I applaud what you're trying to do, and best of luck in everything that you're doing.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking with Isra Hirsi. Good luck to you. We're going to take a break, folks, and when we get back, I got a few more notes that we got to pass along, and you're listening to the Mike McEntee Show here on AM 950.
Kevin Ross here, inviting you to our brand new store called Ambibulous. What does Ambibulous mean? It means one who enjoys alcoholic beverages of all sorts. Ambibulous is a Minnesota maker's market. Unlike traditional liquor stores, we feature only craft beer, wine, and spirits made here in Minnesota. We are ready to guide your selections, where you can build your own four or six packs. Find us at 949 Hennepin Avenue East in Northeast Minneapolis or online at ambibulousmn.com.
Hello, AM 950 listeners. I am Tabitha Montgomery, Executive Director at Powderhorn Park Neighborhood Association, where we believe in connecting, informing, inspiring, and advocating for community. One of the ways that we are doing that is with our first annual Powderhorn Shark Tank Small Business and Big Ideas Competition for local makers, hustlers, and entrepreneurs throughout Minneapolis. Don't miss your chance to submit your application online at ppna.org/Powderhorn Shark Tank. Again, that's ppna.org/Powderhorn Shark Tank. Applications will close at 12 a.m. on March 11th. Don't miss your chance. And be sure to mark your calendars for the actual Powderhorn Shark Tank event on Saturday, May 19th from 2:30 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Powderhorn Park Recreation Center. See you there.
Hello, friends. I've been talking to you about Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens, Minnesota's first green cemetery dedicated to celebrating life and protecting our environment. One of the many wonderful things they have is something called the Living Urn. Ashes are buried in an urn with seedlings, ultimately coming back to life as a glorious tree. Isn't that a beautiful thing? Why don't you log on to the website, mngreengraves.com. Learn more about Prairie Oaks Memorial Eco Gardens. See if it might be something that's meaningful for you.
Settle down, it'll all be clear.
Welcome back to the Mike McEntee Show. Yesterday on the show, we were talking about State Senator Karen Housley's sudden announcement that the sexual harassment legislation that's been making its way through the Minnesota House and Senate is going to be deep six this year because of concerns from the business community. The full House had voted for it, I think unanimously, for eliminating the requirement that someone's actions or words must be, quote, severe or pervasive in order to constitute sexual harassment. That's making it a much lower bar for bringing a case. Housley, as you know, is running for the U.S. Senate, for Al Franken's seat against Tina Smith. Governor Dayton today blasted the Chamber of Commerce for trying to convince Housley to stop the legislation.
For the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce to be opposed to strong, enforceable sexual harassment protection, I mean, I just don't think they represent Minnesota businesses. I don't think Minnesota businesses, business owners right across the state want that kind of ambiguity and want not to have their employees to have the kind of protection that Representative Pepin would provide. But, you know, they've got their obvious and they go, oh, bend somebody's ear, and then they get it derailed in the Senate, which is shameful.
Yeah. And on that race, Tina Smith, according to the new poll here from the Morning Consult, her approval rating is up a point and her disapproval rating is down to 20%. Deserves re-election, 25% people say. That's up 1 point. Time for a new person, though, 30% down 1 point. Keeping an eye on that. Tina Liebling, by the way, endorsed Rebecca Otto for governor today. We'll be back here tomorrow. I'm Mike McEntee. Thank you for listening. And Mom, thank you for listening, too.